Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunked. Today we have another special guest. It seems like every day we have special guests. All guests are special guests on Cypherpunked. Patrick, are you back?
I'm here.
All right, we're going to be doing a special little show on an introduction to Loom, Loom for Dummies. This is going to be a non-technical show. Patrick, why don't you tell us little bit about yourself and the Loom project, and then we'll start right into it.
Okay, thanks, Hero. Yes, my name is Patrick Jacorth, and I've been in the digital currency arena for many years now. Back in 2002, I was thinking about alternative systems, systems that were a little different from the account-based systems that were out there at the time. Systems that would emphasize privacy and security. And I thought long and hard about a lot of different concepts and approaches. And one day in 2005, I thought, look, what is the simplest possible way of representing payments, of doing payments on the internet? The very simplest possible way. Let's cut through the clutter, get rid of any extraneous ideas, and just cut it down to utter simplicity. And I thought, I got it. I know what to do. I'm just going to pretend like the entire universe is one big set of locations. And when you want to pay somebody, you'll move money from one location to another location. And then the recipient can pick it up and move it to another location. All there is a big set of locations where assets can reside. And if you think about it, this isn't too alien a concept. It's actually quite natural. It's the way things work in the real world a lot of times. Like when you go into an ordinary retail store and pay for something with cash, you have a location, which is your wallet or purse, and that's where your personal money resides. And no one can get at it except you. And when you want to pay the cashier, you take some money out of your wallet and you move it out of the secure wallet and you put it onto the countertop at the retail store. Now it's in a shared location where the assets are up for grabs between the two of you, between you and the cashier. The cashier then, as a second step, moves the assets from the countertop into the cash register. The cash register is a location where only the cashier and the owner of the store can reach the money, can get at the money.
Right.
So it's a very natural way of thinking of things. Now, as it turns out in Loom, I arranged all these locations in a big grid, and I think the best way to get this analogy across is to imagine a bank with a secure vault and a huge wall of safe deposit boxes on the back wall. And there are many rows and many columns of safe deposit boxes, and they're all numbered. The rows are numbered and the columns are numbered. And let's pick an asset that I might own. Classic example is gold, something everyone knows, everyone recognizes, everyone places some value on. Could be anything. It could be bushels of wheat, coffee beans, silver, 500 euro notes. It could even be a unique item like a Van Gogh sketch, where only one exists. An asset is anything that people consider valuable, and it's something that can be owned, and it's something that can be counted. That is, if my safe deposit box has 20 gold coins in it, I have 20 of the same kind of gold coin. Let's say they're all Krugerrands. They can be counted. My stash can be divided into pieces. So if I want to pay some of my assets, I can go to my safe deposit box and grab some gold out of it and move it somewhere else into another box in that same row. Here's the problem, though. Let's say I wanted to pay Hero. It's on the other end of this payment. He's the recipient. Now, Hero has his own secret safe deposit box somewhere in that same row. Mm-hmm. I don't have the key to that box. I shouldn't have the key to that box, because it means I could control or possibly steal all of Hero's assets. Not that I would, but it's possible. Right. So Hero has a special locked place that only he knows about and only he can get into, let's say. So I can't just take the gold out of my secret box and then jam it directly into Hero's secret safe deposit box.
Right, just like the cash register.
Just like the cash register. Right. Yes, that's right. If in the retail setting, imagine if I took the money out of my wallet and instead of putting it on the counter and allowing the cashier to pick it up, imagine if I just arrogantly and rudely just reached over and hit the cash button on the cash register and just jammed the cash right in there myself and saved the cashier the trouble. How do you think that would go over?
Yeah.
Not too well, I imagine. So there's this, it needs to be two steps. So how does that work in the safe deposit analogy? The way it works is this. I take, let's say my box number is 1037. And Hero's box number is 2542. I'm just choosing a couple numbers at random just to pin the discussion down a little bit here. Now, I don't take my gold coin out of box 1037 and jam it directly into box 2542. What I do instead is I go to a box somewhere else. Maybe it's box number 1978. And I take the gold coin out of my safe deposit box, and I put it into box number 1978. That's the first step of the payment. Mm-hmm. Then what I do is I tell Hero, the gold coin is in box 1978. And here's the key. Now I'd like you to just go pick it up. So now Hero goes to box 1978, opens it up, grabs the coin out of it, and moves it to his own box 2542. Now the transaction's complete.
So that shared box works just like that's our little personal counter
It's like the counter.
Right.
That's right. And the secret in our retail store analogy, the secret location was my wallet in my pocket, no one else could get to. And the cashier's secret location was the cash register that no one could get to. Unless they wanted to get their hand slapped, they couldn't get into it. And the shared location was the countertop, where you put something down, it's up for grabs. Now let's think about paying the other way. Even in a retail store, it might even go the other way. What if I got a refund? Or what if I got change for a purchase? I gave the cashier $20 for a $12 item. So I put the $20 on the countertop. The cashier picks it up, puts it in the drawer, takes out $8 and change, puts it right back on the countertop exactly where the original payment went, and then I pick it up from there and put it into my wallet. Mm-hmm. Loom works the same way. Two people who are paying each other typically always use the same location as that intermediate drop point. That actually makes it really nice, really convenient. If you come back to the safe deposit box analogy, what's nice about it is the first time I pay Hero, I have to tell Hero that the coin is at box 1978. But after that, I don't need to tell him every single time. If I want to pay him, I just take a gold coin out of my box, put it into box 1978, and I don't even have to say anything.
Right, because really, next time I log in into the Loom system, I these locations listed, and I see in this location that we use, with, and we have it labeled, you know, our Patrick Hero's account, you know, location. I that's see right. a positive balance in there. And
yeah, that's right.
Now, when I see that, I need to pick that up, and then explain the what happens when I see that money sitting there.
You log in. It's incredibly easy. It's one click. Mm-hmm. Next to you see section of your screen. It literally says on the table, and it puts the name of the drop point where it is, and it shows one Krugerrand. Let's say we're using whole Krugerrands, mm-hmm. and to the right of where it says one Krugerrand, there's a link that says claim asset. That's it. You just click that link, and it moves from the contact point, the shared drop point, into your own private stash.
Right.
One click.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's pretty simple. I think that a lot of people imagine using these online payment systems similar to PayPal or PecUnix, and many people have experience with the defunct eGold, where they pay into a particular account, and the system then just takes these little numbers and adds them, subtracts them from account balances and the like. So explaining this out is very nice, because many people come to Loom and they wonder, well, you know, what's going on here? This is very nice.
Yeah, I think that it would help. It helps to know this one basic concept, because then the user interface makes sense.
Yeah.
You know what's going on. It's a surprise if you're expecting a PayPal or an eGold type interface. Loom is a surprise, and it could throw you off, and you might get confused and run away. But now that you know the simple, drop-dead simple concept behind it, I think it becomes extraordinarily simple to use. In fact, I think that when you log in, the payment process is, I would maintain, the most streamlined payment process you'll ever see. So if I want to pay you, let's say I log in, and I want to pay you one gold coin, right at the top it says pay assets, and there's a quantity field. My cursor is just sitting right there. I just type in one, and then under the asset dropdown, I choose gold coin, and under contact, I choose Hero, and then I press the pay button, and I see on the table at Hero one gold coin. And that's kind of like that represents the gold coin sitting there in box 1978 in our discussion. Also, note that even the payer sees a claim asset link to the right of it. I see on the table, Hero, one gold coin, and to the right of one gold coin it says claim asset. I can take it back if I want. Maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I typed in the number two gold coins and I only meant to pay you one. I can claim it right back and pay you the correct amount.
Right. So it's also on the table. It works out the same analogy. The money gets set down on the table. You know,
if the cashier doesn't pick it up,
right? You can, you know, grab. Oh, that's a 20. I'm at a 10. You throw a 10 down.
Oh, yeah. Just take it right back and put it down. As long as you get it before she gets it, mm-hmm. he or she picks it up, then you can take it back. That's a nice feature. against mistakes. There is no "are you sure" type of confirmation when you make a payment. It's just kind of nice. You don't really need an "are you sure." You can just take it back if you make a mistake. Also, what's really nice is, let's say that that I, in a traditional system, PayPal or eGold, gold money, if I paid someone in an account-based system, it would go straight into their account. It would be irretrievable. Now, what if the recipient said, "Oh, I wish you hadn't paid me those 8 ounces of gold into that account because I forgot my passphrase, and now it's lost forever. I can't get it." Yeah. That's not going to happen here. If the other guy doesn't pick it up, if the recipient doesn't pick it up, it's still sitting here at the drop point. I can just take it right back. No harm done.
Right. Can you
now, I mentioned...
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
There was something we talked about earlier about how we labeled this drop point, this box 1978. And there's an interesting thing that happens in Loom. You mentioned that the box 1978 was labeled Hero and Patrick's shared location, right? You could label it that way. What's interesting about the Loom interface is each party labels it the way he or she wants to label it. So in my wallet, I would add contact point 1978, and I would label it Hero, quite simply.
Okay.
Because when I pay you a gold coin, I just want to drop down the contact list and just see the word Hero there.
Yeah. Throw them on.
Right? I don't want to see Hero. I don't want to see Hero and Patrick shared location. I just want to see the word Hero.
Yeah.
And if I know two heroes, I'll just tack an email address or a last name on the end of it.
Yeah.
Now, on the flip side, when Hero logs in and he adds contact point 1978 to his wallet, he's not going to call it Hero. He's going to call it Patrick.
Right.
If he wants. Right. So it's an asymmetric sort of thing. And that's the system in a nutshell.
That's very nice.
How it operates. Yeah.
Can you tell us in a very simple way, what is the easiest way that you could explain to people, why is this system like this? Why didn't you do a PayPal account-based system or we're used to without, you know, I know there's some real technical reasons underneath that are about security and privacy and stuff, and maybe some of those you can cover, but, you know, what can you tell us about that? Why did you do this?
Sure. Yeah, why? That's a good question, because I certainly could have done yet another account-based system. In fact, in the early years, I did prototype something that I was calling yet another account-based system, YABS, YAABS. and I did that, and I thought, well, I think that this system, the way it's done here, can lead to some very simple usage models. The example I have in mind here is paying for something on a website. Look at the way a lot of payments are done on websites now. The simplest way, let's forget PayPal for a minute. Let's just think of the most successful payment system on earth at the moment. And that is credit and debit cards.
Right.
Forget PayPal, forget Google Checkout, forget everything. In fact, PayPal and Google Checkout are just front ends for credit card payments for merchants who don't want to have merchant accounts and bother with that. All right, but a credit card is the easiest thing because when you go to check out, you just see a form, like if you're shopping on Amazon, you just see a form that says, enter your credit card number, and you just type in a credit card number. And then you press the button, and Amazon is paid. They just debit the amount from your credit card. Loom lends itself perfectly to that exact same usage model. The number, that number 1978, is like a little refundable debit card.
Right.
So if I'm shopping, right, if I'm shopping at Amazon and I want to pay for something and they say enter your credit card number, perhaps Amazon would allow a Loom payment option and they would say enter a contact ID, enter your contact point. And I could just copy and paste this number right out of my Loom wallet into the Amazon site and press the pay button, and it takes the money. It just doesn't get any simpler than that. In fact, well, it does get even simpler than that. What's nice is this. Now, what if I wanted to avoid having to copy and paste that number into the Amazon site every single time? Well, how about if I just go right into the Amazon site and it remembers my number? I could store it in a cookie. Or I have a bookmark to it that has my number in it. So when I just click to the Amazon site and it says, "Welcome back, Patrick," I don't even have to log in, because it sees that number and it looks it up in the customer database and says, "Oh, that's Patrick." And now it remembers my order history. It remembers my shipping address. It can look up the balance on that number and see that I have 248 Amazon bucks there. And I can just go in and shop, go to checkout. I don't have to paste in a number. It already has it. And I just say pay, and it debits the number. So that's as easy as it can possibly get, I maintain.
Right. Now, when you have this shared location thing with Amazon, then if you, let's say they had some type of affiliate or commission system that you were tied into, and you gained these Amazon bucks, they could just dump them right into this account. And that balance would be available. That doesn't necessarily mean those are all the Amazon bucks that you have. Those are just the Amazon bucks that are on the table.
Yeah.
So you can spend them and use that balance on the table right then and there for
sure.
Purposes.
I don't even have to move. I don't even have to lift a finger.
Right.
That's right.
That's with a merchant. If you grab those off the table and you have them in your account, then you move to another level of the Loom system when you're just dealing with a payment system like a credit card system. You can take those Amazon bucks and send them to other people in the Loom system. And then they throw them down on their table with Amazon and make their payments. So
that's right. For example, if I'm shopping at Amazon with Amazon bucks, let's say, maybe they don't take gold. Maybe they have Amazon bucks or Amazon credits. Forget the word buck. Amazon credits. It's an abstract number. It's not even tied to a currency. And they could price all their goods in a constant number of Amazon credits. This DVD player, or this DVD, let's say, costs 15 Amazon credits. Maybe there is a loose tie to the dollar. Who knows? Point being, when I want to shop at Amazon, I would have in my Loom wallet, I might have a totally different drop point for Amazon, not the 1978 that I share with you.
Right.
What I might do is choose 4421, and I would label that Amazon. When I wanted to shop at Amazon, I would pay, let's say, 200 Amazon credits, and it would move from my box 1037 over to box number 4421, and now there's 200 there. And then I go to Amazon, and I carry in that 4421 with me in a cookie or in the URL of the browser, and it remembers who I am and sees the 200 there. I check out, and it debits the money. Maybe I just leave the balance there. Maybe I pay 15 credits, and it just leaves the 185 sitting there. Now, when I refresh my Loom wallet, I'm going to see 185 sitting there instead of 200. Mm-hmm. If I wanted, I could click the claim asset link and just take them right back. But you know what? It's in safe hands. Why not just leave them sitting there? Amazon isn't going to steal them. Mm-hmm. That way, when I click through, I don't have to Amazon next time. I don't have to refund that debit card. I can just let it sit there.
Yeah.
It's in safe hands.
It's furthermore, that they do when you give them your credit card. I mean, you could say, "Well, they have my credit card number." Well, yeah, sure, they
same
have
thing.
It, and they could go and charge all kinds of stuff, you know, on it if they wanted to.
That's right.
But you know, you trust them in the first place to give them a credit card, that they're not going to do that. So, you know,
that's right.
It's the same.
And same thing happens here. You might not want to put all 25,000 of your Amazon credits at the shared drop point just in case.
Yeah.
But leaving some petty cash around is no big deal, and it's convenient.
Right.
And then, as you said, Amazon could be doing affiliate payments, and I log into my Loom wallet tomorrow, and instead of seeing 185 there, I see 197. I just earned 12 credits.
Right.
That just almost paid for the DVD player, the DVD I bought yesterday. And they just pile up. Every once in a while, I could sweep some off. So the point being here is that I have one contact point 4421 that I share with Amazon, and I have a totally different contact point 1978 that I share with Hero. And you'll do that. You'll have a different contact point for each party with whom you deal.
Right. Now, you're using these numbers as an example, but you don't have to choose numbers. The system does that for you.
System does that for you. Right. It chooses a random number. And you might think, now, wait a minute, this is interesting, because a security-minded listener might say, well, why doesn't – I could just go into that bank vault you're talking about here, and I could just scan through all the boxes. I could just go look in box 1037 or box 1978 or 2542 or 4421 and just keep searching through them and see if there's any gold or Amazon credits in there and just take them. You see, that leads to the interesting little secret about the Loom system. There is no separate key to these boxes. They're all just open. Now, this may sound a little scary until you hear the next part of what I'm going to say. There is no separate key. The key itself is just knowing where it is. Now, if all you have is a row of, let's say, 10,000 boxes, that could be pretty insecure.
Right.
Because you could just scan through all those and loot them. As it turns out, in Loom, you have met much more than 10,000 boxes. You have, the number is 2 to the 128th minus 1. Okay, for people who want to hear that a little bit more in English, I would say that that number is, here's the number. It's, how many zeros is that? 2, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30, 33, 36. Okay, let's call it 38 zeros.
Okay.
It might even be 39. Okay, so take a million boxes and say, well, that's not good enough. Even a million boxes is too insecure. All right, then take a million boxes. All right. Well, no, that's not secure enough. Let's take a million boxes. No, keep going. How about a million? Basically, you have to do 6 into 38. You basically have to do a million boxes, something like that.
Okay.
It's absurd. It's an absurdly high number. And given that number, that many boxes in this giant bank vault, now it becomes secure. Because I don't really have my assets sitting at location 1037. I have them sitting at some big number in between zero and a million. And that's going to be hard to guess. So you don't need a separate key that you give someone to go unlock the box. You just tell them where it is, and the door is wide open. And they just reach in and grab it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So
the key. The location is the key. Let's just put it that way.
Right. And when you're dealing with numbers that big, it's the same as the numbers when you're dealing with regular encryption. So, you know, if you think, well, I wouldn't, you know, this is wide open if someone guesses the location. It's similar to guessing the encryption key for a particular banking session that you may be logged in doing a financial transaction for someone to guess that or to guess some other type of very highly secure access method.
That's right. It's just as difficult. Mm-hmm. And someone could, as you say, guess your not only your passphrase, well, actually guessing your passphrase is a lot easier than guessing one of these giant numbers.
Right. Yes.
A lot. Your username and passphrase, if they could guess those two things, they essentially have control over your $120,000 in the bank. And that's far less secure than what we're talking about. So
right.
People need to realize that we're doing a pretty good job of security here.
Right. A couple of other things I can see in this system that are inherent in the e-gold. I like to use the e-gold as an example just because so many people are familiar with the interface and how it works. What was the other one you mentioned, the gold money?
Gold money, okay. Yeah, and PayPal.
Well, I'm thinking of the systems that have non-repudiation of the payments. When you make a payment, it
right.
goes across, and it's it's final. The settlement of the transaction is final. In this system, there's an intermediate point where the money's on the table between then and the time the person picks it up. But once they pick it up, it's in their account. In the credit card payment systems and in PayPal, you can open up a dispute or and that leads to open up a dispute or in some systems just do a direct, like in credit card payment systems, you can just call up your bank and do a chargeback. And what that does is immediately or within a short period of time rips that money right out of the merchant's account and on top of it usually gives them a smack on the hand, another chargeback charge. Mm-hmm. So, and that can be quite significant for many people. I've had experiences with it as much as 60 euro with one credit card processing charge. Provider that I was for a chargeback. But it's usually quite less than that.
And so, you can have frozen accounts as well.
Right. And one of the big scams out there is the and they do this with PayPal. They do it with many systems, but especially with PayPal, where someone will go, they'll hack into someone's account or take money from their account. They'll use it to pay someone for physical items, like an iPhone or a computer.
Car. Yeah. I've heard that one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's a classic example.
Yeah, and the person receives the money, they send out the goods, they make good on the delivery, and it's delivered to an address where someone is on watch out and the owner is on vacation or the like. The goods come in, they pick up, they sign, and then they disappear with the goods. And the owner of the original money that the payment was made from, their account or stolen, they're sitting there with this money gone, and they say, hey, no way. And they initiate a dispute or a chargeback, and then the money is then ripped out of the original seller's account, and he's left there with no goods and no money. Now this happens. This is a big scam.
He did nothing wrong.
Right, nothing. Yeah, and many times the scam in a simple way happens. There's several different types here. And one type is a person actually does this out of their own account. And when that happens, PayPal security services, they will rip that money out or close the account or, you know, and refund the money back to the original person. But when there's a third party involved, and this actually is what was the catalyst for the fall of the DMT, the Digital Monetary Trust, system by J. Orland Graeby, was they had a massive fraud network that did this exact thing with large screen TVs and the like for tens of thousands of dollars, but they didn't do it with PayPal. They did it with wire transfers. And a lot of people don't know this, but when you send out, when you get a wire transfer from someone and you think, well, you can pay me with the wire transfer, I'm not going to accept credit card because you could charge back or it could be fraud, but I'm going to trust a wire transfer. That's not so, because the banks have the ability to do reversals. And sometimes they may not just do a reversal very easily if you send money to someone and then you just claim, hey, I changed my mind or I didn't like the product or the like. But in specific cases that are documented, if you can show that the wire transfer was sent out with stolen funds or without your authorization and you know, different methods like that, many times the banks will just do a reversal. And what will happen in that case is, even if it's a month or two down the road, you're sitting here with $10,000 in your bank account, and the bank will just rip if it was the original $5,000 that you had received someone, they just rip it right out of your account.
Yeah, that can happen.
Right then
and that can hurt.
Right.
That hurts.
Absolutely.
Especially if people lose,
you know, months afterwards and you think that everything's fine and dandy. And in that case, you lose, if you were the original, if this was a transaction for goods that you sent out, not only do you lose the $5,000, you also lose the the goods, the cost of the goods that you had your original capital that you had used to purchase the goods. So in a system like Loom, when you make a payment, the payment is final when the transaction is complete. And there are many good things with that. There are so many people that are selling things in online right now that cannot use PayPal. I tried this before. One time I saw on eBay a while back, I was doing some buying and selling on there, and I had some pretty good luck with buying some gold and silver coins, and it was working out pretty well. I had a nice little relationship with several people who were selling these things, and they were accepting PayPal payments, so you know, it was
okay.
Nice. And they were sending me gold for a little bit of a markup with PayPal money, and that's pretty
amazing.
Nice, you know. Now,
what's to prevent you from doing chargeback on them if you were a scammer?
Right. Yeah, but it worked out well. So then I saw that at the same time that people were needing e-gold, and I had some excess e-gold at that time.
Well,
not excess, but I had e-gold that I was interested in going ahead and cashing out. And I wouldn't mind getting some PayPal for that. You know, so
sure, why not?
Right. So
free market.
Right. So I
or accepted, is it?
Yeah, I accepted PayPal for some e-gold, and they were paying a nice little premium price on it. And man, I did that about four times over the period of 2 weeks, and not for large amounts, and just between 50 and 100 bucks, and all four of them, bam, turned out to be completely fraud. And I had checked these, you know, done the basic PayPal eBay thing where you're checking the email addresses, making sure that the email that they're communicating with you with, and that they used on the eBay account and the pay, but these guys had infiltrated it and had complete control over these people's accounts. But they
For goodness sake.
Right, and so that verification at that level was working out, and I even did a couple of phone calls to them to verify. But then it turned out to be that I guess a couple of them were completely legit, but they were doing this this where they build up a reputation, and then once they'd get a nice little job done, then they disappear. And then
build it up and cash out on the reputation. Go ahead and ruin the reputation.
Right.
One then, big cash out.
And then do the PayPal dispute and then get the money ripped back out. So in this system, you're not going to have a merchant reach into your, to use the previous analogy, to reach into your wallet or your bank account and rip out money based on the fact of some scammer playing the system.
That's right.
And
that's right.
And another thing you're not
going to
– go ahead.
Well, there could be some – there are some dangerous situations you need to watch out for in a system like this. It won't be chargebacks, but it's simply analogous to someone stealing your wallet in the real world. They just mug you on the street, take your wallet. Or you leave it on a countertop and someone takes the wallet. Well, they now have all your assets. Mm-hmm. And that can happen in Loom. It's very much like digital cash. And the way that works on the computer is typically with phishing, where someone sends you an email and says, click here and log into your Loom account, and they lead you to a site, loom.cc, and you don't know the difference. And your browser, it's https loom.cc. Your browser says, well, that's signed by GoDaddy. It's fine. Okay. It doesn't even warn you. And so, you see, if you were using a thing like Cert Patrol in Firefox, it would warn you and say, hey, wait a minute. You've never used this site before. I've never seen this before. loom.cc. And you'd be alerted. But a lot of people don't use Cert Patrol in Firefox or a similar product. And they just blindly go into loom.cc because the certificate is signed by GoDaddy.
Right.
All right. So now they're in there, and it looks just like the real Loom site. So they just type in their passphrase. And guess what? The hackers have even made it look like your real Loom account. Like, after you type in the passphrase, they actually hit the Loom API and grab all your contents and display it to you, and you really think you're at the real Loom site. Well, here was the mistake that you made if you fell for this. Someone sent you an email, and you clicked a link in it. That's mistake number one.
Okay.
Don't do it. I guess if someone's sending you a YouTube link to a chipmunk video, it's fine. But never click a link in an email and log in via that link. On the Loom site, if you go to loom.cc and then click through to the secure site, you'll see some security advice up there that says, quite simply, what you should do is bookmark the real site in your browser and always visit Loom from the bookmark.
Right.
If you do that, you're going to be just fine. As long as you have some reasonable antivirus software on your computer, some kind of Symantec or, there's another one that I think is really good, but the name escapes me right now, that'll protect against viruses that are watching your keystrokes. And as long as you bookmark that loom.cc site, you should be fine.
Yeah, you'll bypass most of the easiest and most common social engineering tricks that these guys do with links inside of emails and on bogus websites.
Sure. Sure. Just ignore.
Go ahead. We have about 20 minutes here left on the show, mm-hmm. and we've covered the basic operation of the system and how we can picture inside of our heads how it works, and it's quite easy, very, very easy to use the system once you understand just this, basically the wallet, counter, cash register, and this location issue with the boxes. This is really nice moving these items between the different boxes. The question that many initial users are going to have the first question is going to be, where do I access Loom? How do I get an account? And how do I, once I have an account, how do I get money into the system and out of the system? So why don't we try to cover the show.
Yes, good idea. Good idea. Right now you'll notice that if you go to loom.cc and go to the secure site, you see a page that asks you to type in a passphrase and push the login button. A new user is looking at this thinking, well, I don't have a passphrase, what do I do? Well, we do have a link that says you may sign up here. Okay, that's great. So I'm the new user. I'm going to click sign up. I click it, and it says, all right, choose a passphrase. Enter the passphrase twice. And then, what's this step three down here? Paste in your invitation. Invitation? I don't have an invitation. Why can't I sign up at this place for free? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. Well, the answer is you can't sign up at Loom for free. Using the Loom system, it costs, for want of a better phrase, it costs money to use the Loom system. And I don't really mean the word money. I mean it costs these little usage tokens. There's an asset. If you go into the bank vault, there's a row at the top there, which is for usage tokens. And a usage token is like a disk quota. It gives you a limit on how much space you can use on the server. A lot of people are familiar with this idea. You've got a quota. If you're in Gmail, it tells you you've got 6-7 gigabyte quota. There's a limit on how much you can put on the system.
Right.
Usage tokens are a measure of your quota. It tells you how much space you're allowed to use. So an invitation is a contact point that someone who's already in the system creates and funds with 100 usage tokens and gives to you, like through Skype or email, or reads it to you on the phone, sends it to you in the mail, written down on a piece of paper. And you get this code, and that's what you put into step three there.
Okay. If I can try to explain something here, a lot of people would be, because we don't need to get into too many details of how the usage tokens work and the background behind them. Mm-hmm. I think I can sum up one of the reasons why. Inside the Loom system, when you make a payment between, when you're moving assets around and making payments and receiving them, it's happening between you and the other user only. The system is not in the middle taking a slice of the transaction, every single transaction that happens. That's how these systems are that's part of their business model and how they make money. $1,000 goes through, they take a couple of percentage if it's like a PayPal or a credit card and the like. Off the top, that's not even that's not something that the merchant is taking. This is something that the processor is taking. And even eGold had a micro percentage that they took off of every little transaction. So when you pay someone 10 gold coins, that person's going to get 10 gold coins.
So you got it. No pieces of the gold coins get shaved off and fly over to the bank.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and that's one reason for these usage tokens, because it allows the system to be it allows the operator of a Loom server to have some type of a system where he can pay for his server, pay for his bandwidth, pay for the maintenance. There is some type of a business model that's going to be there besides just putting up this system where he has to literally get in there and spy on every – I call it spy because it's basically what it is. In order for
like an eye in the sky.
Yeah, for someone to have a system where they're shaving off a little bit off of each transaction, one, they're going to have to be monitoring the and recording the amount transferred between each person, each account, and each asset. And they're going to need to not just monitor and log it and record it, because there needs to be a record of, hey, how come the system has taken up this much money off of my from my transactions, because it's all being audited and controlled and accounted for. And in back to this, you know, bank vault type thing where you're talking like a wall of like safety deposit boxes, it's the same thing. When you go in there and you move something that is in one of your safety deposit boxes to another safety deposit box, the bank is not going to sit there and say, sorry, we want 0.01% of what you're moving and forth.
Imagine if you were moving the Van Gogh sketch. Oh, we want to just clip with a piece with scissors, clip a little edge off the Van Gogh sketch. That will be our take. Doesn't work, does it?
No, it doesn't. So the business model works at another level, and that's where
you're
paying for the location.
To extend that analogy, these boxes essentially have a little slot, almost like the lockers at an ice skating rink, where you put in a usage token, and that opens the box and allows you to put things in there. And so I would stick a usage token in box 1978, which would enable me to open it and put a gold coin in there. And then it just stays open. The door just swings wide open to anyone who wants to walk up to it. A hero goes in there and he grabs it. Now, if I'm done with box number 178, I can click the coin return. First of all, the box has to be empty. Okay. If the box is empty, then I can click the coin return, and my usage token pops back out, and the box is locked again and unusable.
You know, a great analogy that you used in another show that we did was you talked about some of the food chains in the U.S. I know one of them in the Northwest is a cheap food provider named Aldi's, and I'm sure many other places have this, but they have their shopping carts. They have the same system where they have usage tokens for their shopping carts. So when you go up there, you're not going to see shopping carts lying all over the parking lot, or anyone going out there and collecting them, because everyone cleans up after themselves. Because why? When they got to the store, they walked to go into the door, and here's these rows of shopping carts, and they're all linked together with these little chains and a little slot. Mm-hmm. And in the slot, you stick a quarter. When you put the quarter in, the little lock releases, and you have your buggy. You take your buggy, you do your shopping. When you're done, you walk out and put your groceries in the car, and you have this cart there. If you leave that cart in the parking lot, someone else is going to run up and grab it and take it back up there, plug
it
back
in, the quarter.
And get the quarter. And that really doesn't happen. People go in there, they get done, they walk up there, pop it in, get the quarter out. And this is exactly the same thing. But in the loom system, you don't actually have to put, you don't have to think about putting these quarters into these locations.
The wallet interface takes care of that. Yeah, as you use your wallet, you'll notice that your usage token balance is just fluctuating a little bit because, you moved something to a new contact location and it had to buy that location, it had to put the usage token in the slot so it could open it up, and you'll see it fluctuate. Right. Also, whenever you, if you're doing things in your wallet, making transactions and picking assets up and paying them out, you can turn on a history feature, which only you can see. This is a history just right in your own wallet where it scribbles down. It writes down everything that you're doing with a timestamp and what contact point was involved, what asset and what quantity. And you can even put a memo on it. It's a real nice place to, if someone pays you something and you claim the asset, you might want to scribble into the memo, oh, I need to deliver this DVD player to this address. It's a nice handy feature. Well, storing those memos requires space on the system. So the system charges you usage tokens to store those memos. But again, it's just like the shopping cart analogy where if I delete that memo because it's old and I don't care about it anymore, I get a refund of all those usage tokens.
Right. Yeah, so you can have a little balance in there. And for your general usage, they're going to go up and down. And you can clean up after yourself sometimes. And if you need more usage tokens, you can you can buy them on through the various methods. We can cover that possibly on another show.
Or you can beg them for a friend. Please, right. Please give me some.
Yeah, exactly. You can also, if you have extra usage tokens and you want to send some to other people, then you can send them. Because usage tokens are just another asset. Okay, we're running out of time here and there's two more things that I wanted to cover. One is what are most people think of we've used PayPal as an example many times right now, and gold money. And in those examples, those systems only have a single currency. Maybe they'll have different currencies, yen and dollars and the like. But in Loom, there are quite a few assets that are out there. In another show, we will cover about how anyone, wonderful little things with Loom, anyone can issue their own assets, their own instruments, their own currencies and the like, and we'll go into how you can do that in a future show. But right now, can you give us a rough idea of many of the different types of Loom assets that are out there? Let's do about 5 minutes on that, and then we'll close up with the last 5 minutes on a couple of ways that you can get these assets. You can purchase them or acquire them and sell them.
Right. There are various forms of gold. Obviously, gold is a good choice. It's been the liquid currency of choice for thousands of years. It's now not all gold is created equal. Yeah, it's all gold, but some is stored in this Swiss vault here, and some is stored in a personal vault over there, and those are different asset types. So really, I would have a claim on gold stored in a Swiss vault, and that would be a type of asset. And then another type of asset might be a claim on gold that's stored in South America, in a South American vault. Different things, even though it's both gold. And maybe those vault owners have different reputations, so they're different. You can there's silver, for example. Well, Gold Now Bank, if you go to goldnow.st, they have gold and silver assets that are vaulted. Also, if you go to Loom, if you go to the Global Settlement Foundation, they have gold and silver that are assets there. There's also a coffee company, Capulin.com, that produces shade-grown, fair-traded coffee in Mexico. And coffee beans are an asset. And you can move sacks of coffee from one box to another, essentially.
Right. It's you can do the same thing with the coffee and some of these other assets is that you're not necessarily moving $5 of coffee sometimes or, $5 of coffee bean. You're moving a literal
pound.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me trade you. Right. You could actually trade 1 gram of gold up here for 3 pounds of coffee. And there are no dollars or euros involved at all.
Right.
Now, so that sounds like barter. But as it turns out, some of these assets become very, very widely accepted. That gold is probably more like money than like barter. But you could trade coffee for wheat, and that might be a more difficult trade to find, but it could be done. You could trade a certain amount of coffee for a Rembrandt sketch. It might have to be a lot, but you could do it.
Right. Yeah.
So the asset types are infinite. You know, anything that anyone can conceive of, you could have an asset type which is represents ownership in a company. You can have 37% ownership in a company. That's an asset type. You can have a bond that's payable, let's say, July 2011 at maturity at a certain price. And when it's mature, you trade that bond in for whatever amount of gold is payable or dollars or whatever.
Right.
Now, it's up to every individual to deal with whatever authorities they think they need to have to deal with. People are all over the world are using this. People have different philosophies and different obligations they think they have. You just need to deal with that on your own. I can't advise you there. Well, I suggest you consult your conscience and possibly your attorney.
Right.
If you're doing securities and such. It's not my purview. And so are there some other subjects you wanted to talk about?
One other asset type that is becoming quite popular around the world in many cities and communities are these hours that can be issued, not necessarily a community hour. Well, you could issue a community hour. A LET system could easily be done inside of here. But you can issue your own hours. So if you're a doctor, and like, for example, Dr. Waterman, he has issued some Waterman hours. And with those, you can redeem those for medical consultation or send them to other people and they can use them. So you can use the hours that someone has issued from themselves as your own currency in order to pay for, get back to the coffee example, to pay for some coffee.
Yeah.
And they use those hours.
They go get medical consultation, right? The coffee seller.
Uh-huh.
Well, I traded hours of this professional time for coffee beans from this particular merchant.
Yes.
That's how specific these asset types are.
Right. So, you know, I think we're just going to close up the show on this and we will come back with another episode.
We can talk about how to get these assets, how to get invitations, etc.
Exactly. How to get them and how to exchange them, how to get them inside, get them from inside and from outside the system. But for right now, I think we came up here at the end where we start talking about some very interesting things that start to happen when you have all of these private currencies being issued in the system. It turns into something so much more multidimensional than just a PayPal type system where you're exchanging dollars back
and
forth.
That's right. Loom is not a currency in itself. It's more like economic dial tone. It's like the phone system in a way. It's neutral about what you do with it. It doesn't care. You just use Loom for any purposes you want. It's a very secure server with a general purpose interface, and people can use it to do all of these exotic things we were just describing.
Well, this ends up a episode covering Loom for Dummies. We're going to have two more episodes that are going to be non-technical, very basic introduction in this way. The next one we'll probably cover is going to be getting money assets into and out of the Loom system and within. How do you get started? And then we're going to do a very basic introductory level on how to issue your own currencies, monetize your own hours, and the like. Patrick, thank you very much for coming on today. This has been enjoyable and informative, and I look forward to doing some more shows with you on this.
Right, Hero. Thank you very much.
Dodge this.
this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.